last time talked about a variety of things. Near the end, we were talking about MSU's LIR Center and about joint appointments with the LIR Center and the Economics Department.
Ryan.
And I was just curious a little bit in your involvement with that. I wondered if you had had any involvement with the infamous Senate hearings that were involved with the Labor Center concerning the labor educators making a movie that bothered some in the business community. I don't know if there's anything that you would have any insight different than Steve or others had.
I was very close to Charles Killingsworth at the time of that blow-up, and I got from him a blow-by-blow account of what was going on, and I thought that the university conducted itself the way a university should conduct itself in the face of outside pressure. We're clearly constituted an interference with the academic freedom of the people working in the segment of the university, and I thought that John Hanna came through with flying colors on that.
You know that the labor movement was certainly pleased with it, and they reprinted his statement in the AFL's National Federationist papers and talked about MSU as the people's college. I think was even how they highlighted that.
This is tangential, but it may be of interest to you. During the McCarthy era, I don't know if I mentioned this to you before. In 1952, there was a candidate for Congress in the 6th Congressional District, a fellow by the name of Kit Clardy, C-L-A-R-D-Y. Who ran on a ticket of investigating universities around the country for possible communist infiltration. And he said he was going to start with Michigan State. He was elected in the Eisenhower landslide. And he was assigned, this was surprising, as a freshman in Congress to the House Un-American Activities Committee. And he indeed made noises about investigating Michigan State. Well, at a faculty meeting, John Hanna said to the faculty, if any of you have had any past or current affiliation with the Communist Party or any front organization, please inform the dean, your dean, of that effect, to that effect. And if you don't trust the dean, come and see me about it. There were three people who came forward. All of them were members of the party for a brief period during the 1930s, but had long since left the party. One of them in particular I remember was a professor of English who taught medieval literature of all things. Hannah said these people will be protected. And they were protected. And this stood in marked contrast to the University of Michigan, which froze, they dismissed two members of the faculty. One of them, Lawrence Klein, K-L-E-I-N, who was a member of the Department of Economics. And he went on to the University of Pennsylvania and eventually won a Nobel Prize. So much for that. but Michigan State never had successful McCarthyism on this campus, thanks largely to Hanna's way of handling these things. And Hanna passed the word among his Republican friends in the state, and Kit Clardy was defeated in 1954 by a rather undistinguished, lackluster, mediocre professor of speech at Michigan State. And we never heard from Kit Clardy again.
I don't know much about either the econ department or the business school and college here at the university, and I don't know if there's any relationship to some of those areas or not that I originally was looking at, which was the university in extension in the labor area, and also I'm going to get into some questions about MSU campus unions, but and then faculty unionization efforts.
Okay.
Before I got into those, is there anything I should ask about the business school or the econ
No,
department?
They there was a question in one of the reorganizations, and I can't give you a date, where the question came up whether the economics department should go into the College of Social Science or into the College of Business. And with the exception of one member, it was the unanimous belief that we should go into the business school for purely pragmatic reasons. The history of economics departments has been such that if they were in arts and science or in the College of Social Science, what happened over the years is that the business school would duplicate its courses and really gut the departments of economics so that they would be reduced to teaching only the elementary econ courses, which would be required of business majors. So in order to retain the integrity of the department, it was felt that they should be in the College of Business, and that's what was done, and the department over the years, at least so far, has survived unscathed. There was no erosion of its offerings because of duplication by the College of Business. There is some duplication today in James Madison College, but not in the business school.
Another one that sort of sits on the side as a question, not quite hooked together like the others, is the highlights of your presidency and the anti-war activities here. I assume that's something you've been interviewed before about and it's reported somewhere.
Yes, I think your best source for that is a book I wrote about my experiences. It's called The Test. And I tried, while it was still fresh in my mind, to put it down really for my own sake more than anybody else's, so that I could think analytically rather than purely anecdotally about that experience. But that brief stint in the presidency was really swamped by the period of student unrest and campus disturbances and so on, which was a reflection of the time and the anti-war activities. I made it very clear, despite outside pressure, that I, as an individual, was opposed to the war in Vietnam for purely pragmatic reasons, namely that it, in my opinion, it was not in the best interests of the United States. Therefore, I never had to face the moral question of whether the war was morally correct or not. I could resolve the issue on national security grounds. And I spoke out publicly to that effect. And the student movement against the war considered me an ally rather than an adversary, and this really meant that it contributed to the calm, such as it was, that prevailed on this campus during my presidency. For example, on October 15, 1969, which was designated as Moratorium Day, I marched with the students opposed to the war in Vietnam from the campus to the state capitol. So,
in that book, and I've not read it yet, but I will go take a look at it. I was at undergrad at U of M at that time that you're just discussing, and one of the issues that was highlighted about MSU from the perspective of Ann Arbor was MSU's involvement earlier in the 50s and in the early 60s in various outreach efforts that involved our international program and dean and so forth.
Yeah.
Was that one of the issues you deal with in the book, and was that one of the particularly difficult issues that was focused on the students here?
No, it wasn't a difficult issue for me personally, because I had spoken out against the MSU project in Vietnam. In particular, I had a number of debates with the public debates with the Dean of International Programs, with Neil Stabler, who was chairman of the Democratic Party in the state at the time. So my position was a matter of record. Indeed, our whole international programs bureaucracy had me on their enemies list because of a book I had written in 1960 called Is the World Our Campus?, in which I was extremely critical of government-financed, university-administered technical assistance programs, of which our Vietnam project was one. So I was on their enemies list, and they...
on those supporting the MSU Vietnam Project's enemies list.
Beg pardon? I was on the enemies list of the international programs bureaucracy at Michigan State, which favored these international programs. And they put me on the enemies list because I was opposed to these programs.
Mm-hmm. If it's okay, switch to slightly different area. And that is, I'd like to reflect about MSU as an employer, and maybe first start with not faculty and MSU campus unions and administrative relationships. I believe AFSCME was one of the first that unionized here, and some of those efforts would overlap with some of your most active years too. So I don't know, any thoughts about how and why they unionized MSU and how MSU responded to that and those relations over the years?
Well, I can tell you what my personal relationships were. The unions always considered me as a friend. I was sympathetic to these non-faculty unions. Indeed, again, if I can refer you to the test, I think in the last chapter I have a long discussion of a strike which we had during my tenure in office and how it was resolved. So I think that's the best source I can give you.
Perhaps if you'll let me, I will take a look at that and maybe
and come back
about it afterwards.
Okay.
Okay. Talk about MSU faculty then and the efforts to unionize, and maybe you could start with the historic role of AUP before those efforts, if you want to begin there.
Well, AUP gained strength on this campus over the years. It was a fledgling organization in the late 1940s when I got here. And by the 60s, we were a rather powerful force. I think we had at the high point about 572 dues-paying members, and a lot of faculty who were sympathetic to the role of AUP. And our major objectives really were to civilize the employer-employee relationship that existed between the administration and the faculty. And it was largely due to our pressure that eventually we obtained a grievance procedure to resolve particular problems that existed in certain departments and certain colleges. The second thing that the AUP obtained was a code of student responsibility and student rights, and that was precipitated by the so-called Schiff case, S-C-H-I-F-F. He was a student who was peremptorily dismissed from the university because President Hanna thought that he was a Pied Piper from Peking. And the AU and Schiff finally went to U.S. District Court for the Western District of Michigan in Grand Rapids and filed suit against the university. And the AUP filed an amicus curiae brief with the court in support of Schiff. And finally, the case was settled out of court. Schiff was readmitted, and that was the beginning of the student rights document, which I understand was the first, if not the first, the first or among the first in the country. So that is an AUP achievement. As the grievance procedure started working more effectively, the luster of AUP lessened. If you tried to recruit the new member, they'd always say, "Well, what are the benefits of belonging?" And I would always say to them, "It's like taking out an insurance policy. You don't want to collect on it, or joining the ACLU. You don't join it for any immediate personal benefit, but you want to create an aura, an atmosphere, an ambiance that will prevent administrative outrages, arbitrary actions that disadvantage individuals, whether it be you or somebody else."
Had there been a few of those in that brought a cause of that issue, or was it a more generalized, like the Schiff case, where
their
faculty cases similar?
There were faculty cases, but after AUP intervention, this was before the grievance procedure, they were always satisfactorily resolved. And John Hanna really acted as a court of chancery, and he was a pragmatist. That is, if you explain the facts to him, told them why this was not in the best of the interests of the university, why there was an element of unfairness and an arbitrary decision, he usually saw the point, and it was resolved. Even the Schiff case, I remember I was, I think, president of the local chapter at the time, and I was sitting in my office one Saturday morning, and Hanna got on the phone, and he said, "No, this here Schiff fellow, if I were to readmit him, would he drop his suit? No, would he come back to the university?" I said, "Mr. President, if I may say so, if he comes back, you have been generous, and there is no further problem. If he doesn't come back, then he's the rabble-rouser you originally pictured them as being. You have won in either case. It seems to me that he should not have been dismissed from the university in the first place, and I think would be the proper thing for you to readmit him. He readmitted him, and Schiff came back. And Schiff eventually got a master's degree in history. He was a sort of a salon radical. I mean, I didn't take. He was a student in my class, and I, when he signed up for my class, I'd always hoped that he would bring a Marxist point of view, would express a Marxist point of view, which would be good for the students as a different point of view. There was never a peep out of Schiff in my class. And eventually, after he got his master's degree, he got a job in the U.S. Post Office in Berkeley, and nobody ever heard from him again. He was as much a Pied Piper from Peking as you or I.
Well, you mentioned the faculty grievance procedure. What was the model? Was it basically to just look at unionized grievance procedures, or?
I really don't know. I think it was just a sort of a give and take to set up a grievance procedure, the same way as an anti-discrimination board was set up, and all this was under AUP pressure at the time.
Did those both occur around the same time?
No. No, I think that yes, that as a matter of fact, I think started during my period in the presidency. I suggested that it might be a good idea, since some of the problems seemed to be racial problems, that setting up a mechanism for resolving disputes might contribute to, well, both to a more civilized environment and also for calming troublesome waters.
Anything else to, for people like myself who have a sort of labor relations background, the faculty grievance procedure has a glaring gap in not having an arbitration, final binding, third-party ending. Is there a story or part of a story that you're familiar with about that?
Well, after the grievance procedure was put into effect, then really matters were taken over. Well, let me back up a moment. There was really a growing democratization process that was going on the campus. We had an elected academic council. We had elected faculty committees and so on. And eventually the Committee on Faculty Affairs assumed the role of negotiating with the administration on the rules which would govern the grievance procedure. And that committee, at least as long as I followed its activities, continually pressed for an ultimate resolution such as the one you suggest, that is binding arbitration at the end, rather than leaving discretion in the hands of the president. Okay.
I believe it even resurfaced again just a couple of years ago.
I'm sure it has.
Permanent provost.
Yes.
But again, they decided not to.
That's right.
That route.
That's right.
How about faculty unionization efforts and how and why that came into effect and how AUP reacted and your recollection of that?
Okay, well, I was president of the National AUP from 1972 to 1974. And it was during my administration, if you can call it that, during my tenure in office is a more correct descriptive term. The National AUP accepted collective bargaining by individual chapters as an alternative to the traditional AUP procedures. My argument again was a pragmatic argument. I represented the view with the membership that Harvard may not need a faculty union, that traditional AUP techniques would be adequate to protect the faculty. On the other hand, I felt that we should not foreclose collective bargaining as an instrument for participating in college or university affairs at some autocratic junior college that may want to embrace that as a proper way of dealing and negotiating with the administration. So there should be local option on that, and that the local membership should be in a position to decide whether to go the collective bargaining route or not. Mm-hmm. Okay? And needless to say, there were purists on both sides, those who said collective bargaining should be the only way, and the other side which said our traditional orthodox ways should be the only thing that the AUP stands for. As far as Michigan State was concerned, I always felt that we should not go the collective bargaining way because I felt it would lead to further bureaucratization in faculty administration relationships. I visualized the I always spoke out as an individual on campus affairs, on campus controversies. And I had no hesitation in calling problems to the attention of the president. Well, I could see that in a collective bargaining situation, the president could say to me, well, Walter, that's very interesting, but I can't talk to you about this. Go and see your shop steward. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe for reasons of vanity, I felt that I could make the case possibly more effectively than whoever my shop steward happened to be. And my second reason for opposing collective bargaining for Michigan State.
You were saying that you opposed, or you argued against unionization at MSU.
Yeah, exactly.
Bureaucratization by administrators, faculty relations, you could present your own case better without a shop steward.
Yeah, and as long as the grievance procedure was working effectively, and as long as you had elected committees sharing responsibility, for example, on general pay increases and matters of that sort, I felt the faculty was getting increasing power with respect to decision making at the university. The other reason was a concern that the AUP, in my opinion, should defend faculty rights and faculty tenure as a way of protecting free thought and free expression. Tenure should not be treated as job security in the industrial union sense, but rather as a vehicle to assure First Amendment rights, you might say. and untrammeled freedom to explore intellectual issues wherever they might lead, you see.
Very thoughtful expression. I get into philosophical discussions and I'll stop. There's no reason to take myself. Do you feel, I want to come back to them, but do you feel now that faculty are able, through the grievance procedure, through elected committees, through avenues, to maintain that ideal or that,
the
approximation towards an ideal
the
in the 1990s? Or has it changed or not?
I feel that faculty government has become a big bureaucracy in itself. And what I would hope to be a faculty voice, I don't think is effectively expressed through the current committee system, through the academic council. I don't think there is the kind of forum that I always wished for in an academic environment that would effectively engage issues.
Yeah, which really doesn't argue to the union issue at all. But,
exactly.
But I didn't want to leave the impression that you were saying that you felt today that MSU faculty...
I feel it's... I'm far removed from the decision-making process, and I feel that my elected representatives are really not effectively debating the major issues that should concern the faculty. Notice that I say that should concern. Whether they actually do or not is another matter. But that should concern an academic community. In other words, we now discuss minor issues, and we essentially accept the administration agenda of what the issues ought to be. But this may be peculiar to Michigan State. Where I feel that the quality of administration has declined seriously in the last 10-15 years. So that what we have is a sham democracy, a mechanism, a framework that's more of a shell than any substance, and I find that very disgruntling.
Maybe you can help clarify for me. I tie some of that sense of what you were just saying, plus something else which bothers me, which is kind of a sense of faculty just being sort of lost or just withdrawn from the university as an institution as a whole into their own sub-discipline or whatever.
That's
the sense of hopelessness about the larger.
That's exactly it. That you hit it on the head. There's a certain anomie, you might say, that a disenchantment, a sense of hopelessness, a lack of collegiality and over-specialization. We're a bunch of monks all operating in our little cubicles, and we're overly concerned about our little bailiwick, the little turf that we feel we ought to defend for ourselves. But there's no sense of being a part of a larger organization, a larger unit that is dedicated to some ideals. But maybe that's the way of all flesh, you know. As Emerson once said, once we had golden priests and wooden chalices, now we have wooden priests and golden chalices. And I have the feeling that this has come upon us and maybe about two other large universities as well. We're just giant business organizations, and we don't differ very much anymore, I think, from a General Motors or a Dow Chemical. There are differences in degree, but I should hope that there would be differences in kind, but that may be.
You just remind, I can go in a thousand ways with that sort of a comment, just one easy one. Do you see us, in some sense, like IBM and GM, downsizing in terms of number of producers, that is, in the sense faculty, while maintaining the same output, in this case the same number of students? And where do you see that?
Well, of course, that's going on, and under the pressure of budget constraints. But my feeling is that the problem is that if you look upon a university as consisting of its teaching departments, let us say, and let's say there are roughly 70 teaching departments on this campus. These units, I feel, are being financially starved in the budget allocation process. And more and more of the available funds are going to the periphery, where there is neither teaching nor research going on. I would call it boondoggles, instituted for public relation purposes, or purposes not central to the function of a university. And if there's to be downsizing, a rational downsizing would be the elimination of some of these fringe operations rather than trying to mechanize the teaching operations of the university, especially undergraduate education, which ought to be the central commitment of a Michigan State. But that isn't likely to happen, because we now still pay lip service to Michigan State as the premier land-grant university. But in the same breath, we say we are now the nation's premier land-grant university, but also a great AAU, internationally recognized research university. Well,
this could be an observation I'm incorrect about, but I have a sense that today, except for maybe Honors College or James Madison, there aren't any faculty that would think of sending their children to Michigan State if they had options, even though it's a half pay.
That's absolutely correct.
But 15, 25 years ago, faculty would consider that this was in fact a model place, and better than U of M at the undergrad level, because you had faculty contact. Is that true?
That's exactly my diagnosis. If somebody had asked me in the middle 60s or early 70s, is Michigan State a good undergraduate institution for a bright young person, my answer would have been an unequivocal yes. Today, I would say no. And that's sad. To me personally, that's a sad development. There was a time when one could reasonably argue that this was a better undergraduate institution than the University of Michigan, and I say that without reflection on the University of Michigan. Can we continue this some other time?
Yes, I can.
Okay, I'm sorry.